Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Despite very high odds, Democrats made significant inroads at all levels of elected government, including North Carolina, during last Tuesday's election. Here in North Carolina, they broke the Republican supermajority in the General Assembly that had made laws passed by that body impervious to gubernatorial veto. At last count, Democrats have flipped 15 seats in the State House and Senate, with another possible flip waiting on the results of a final count in the race between incumbent Republican Bill Brawley and Democrat Rachel Hunt. There is no question that since taking over the legislative branch, state Republicans have had an agenda. And when Democrat Roy Cooper became governor 2 years ago, one part of that agenda was to block his. But what is the governor's agenda and that of his Democratic colleagues? What will Democrats do with their newfound power? What can we expect from Raleigh heading into the 2020 election and census? For answers to those and other questions, we welcome Democratic State Senator Jeff Jackson back to our Spirit Square studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Joining us by phone, John Hood, president of the John William Pope Foundation, which describes its mission as working to ensure the freedom to work, pursue individual interests, sustain family, and to prosper. John Hood is also chairman of the John Locke Foundation, the think tank working to ensure a balance between public and private institutions of family, faith, community, and enterprise. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. And joining us via Skype is Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, which provides the state's business community with nonpartisan political research and analysis, as well as education programming. Thank you for joining us again. Welcome back.
My pleasure.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for us on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch at least the senator and I on Facebook Live this morning. Jonathan Kapler, let me start with you because for an election update, because you were named by the Washington Post as among the best state-based political tweeters and the best state capital reporter. So where do the Democratic Party inroads stand right now as ballots were counted over the weekend? Specifically, where does the race between incumbent Republican Bill Brawley and Democratic challenger Rachel Hunt stand this morning?
Sure. That's one of two major outstanding races that could be the outcome of which is still kind of up in the air, depending on how absentee and provisional ballots come out. Right now, actually, the election night results indicated that Representative Brawley was leading by 52 votes, and following absentee ballots that came in following Election Day but are qualified absentee ballots, Rachel Hunt, the Democrat, now leads by 64 votes. And now we still have provisional ballots to go. They will be counted by Friday, this Friday, and then added into the total. Typically, provisional ballots favor Democrats, although they have split evenly in the past in the state House district. And then I don't want to forget about Senate District 9 in Wilmington, New Hanover County, where Harper Peterson, the former Wilmington mayor, looks to have defeated incumbent Senator Michael Lee by 36 votes out of over 86,000 cast, although there are absentee and provisional ballots to go there. So a couple of important contests to hang in the balance, but the bottom line is the Democrats have picked up the seats that they needed to break the Republican supermajority in at least one chamber, and that is a comfortable break in the North Carolina House, where they have picked up at least 9 or 10 seats.
So here and across the country, Senator Jackson, what was anticipated by Democrats to be a blue wave has been more like a slowly rising high tide. It didn't look so good on election night for a long time, and then suddenly the water got higher and higher, and it continues to do that here and around the country. How do you see it? Was this a solid win, a disappointing election for Democrats, or a solid win for Democrats that sets the stage for the next couple of years?
solid win. Even if we had picked up another three or four seats spread between the Senate and the House, it would not have effectively made a political difference. The big political difference in North Carolina is that we broke the supermajority. We only needed to do it in one of two chambers in order to make the governor's veto sustainable. We were able to do it in both chambers, which is great, but really kind of bonus from a political standpoint. Now, when we go back into session in January, the political landscape has been completely reshaped for North Carolina. I'm not sure people fully appreciate how different politics is about to become in North Carolina.
Explain it.
Well, we've had the Republicans in charge, one-party rule, for basically this entire decade. That is effectively over as of the time we go back in January. Every single bill will need the governor's signature, including the budget. And that's going to be the big fight. I project that will be the battle royale next year.
We'll talk a lot about this, but John Hood, you're on the other side of this coin. How do you see it?
Well, I see it the same way. The budget is the most important thing that any legislature ever does. It's the most important bill, not just because it spends the money, but because increasingly lots of policy changes that aren't introduced or perhaps even can't pass as separate bills ended up rolled into the budget. So the fact that Governor Cooper can veto a budget and the Republicans can override him only if they get Democratic votes does change the calculus. Now, if we were having this conversation 10 or 15 or even 6 years ago, I would say the Republicans losing the supermajority doesn't necessarily mean that they can't just override the governor's veto, because there were a number of moderate Democrats in the House and the Senate who on a variety of issues would side with Republicans. And so they might have still assembled, particularly in the Senate, assembled not without too much trouble, a supermajority, and even in the House, potentially. I don't think that's the situation anymore. I think that it will require a lot more horse trading.
One of the things that a lot of people forgot about for the longest time is the gerrymandering. This state has been gerrymandered to a fare-thee-well. The Democrats used to do it. The Republicans certainly did it this time around. It's happened around the country, so that a lot of districts are almost impossible for Democrats to win in, and they did in these districts here in North Carolina and around the country. So when you look at how gerrymandered things are, Senator, does that make this victory for Democrats even sweeter?
Well, a lot of people said you can't call this a blue wave because you didn't pick up these congressional seats in North Carolina. But when you think about the seawall that gerrymandering erected, I think you probably could call it a wave in light of the fact that water did break over this very high seawall. Dan McCready should not have come within 5 or 6 points of winning that congressional seat, and he really outperformed. That seat was drawn to make it virtually impossible for a Democrat to win. Same with the Kathy Manning-Ted Budd race. The fact that she got close was evidence in and of itself of strong outperformance.
So, Jonathan Kapler, you're the nonpartisan here. What's your take on this? Was this a spectacular win because of the fact that we had so many Democratic victories in gerrymandered districts?
Well, I think that there's this ongoing debate as to whether or not this was a blue wave nationally and in North Carolina. And the way that I define a wave is if there are a substantial number of seats that are picked up by the opposition party, that changes the political dynamic in some substantial way. And I think that that certainly did happen in North Carolina. I think Democrats, if you go back and look at the numbers, outperformed previous opposition party gains in a midterm election cycle. And so I think there's ample evidence to point to a wave type dynamic having happened in North Carolina. Having said that, that's really a debate about semantics, and it's really whether or not the outcome substantially changes the political game in Raleigh. And I think that's certainly the case. I do think, to your question specifically, that there are additional structural reasons why it can be difficult for parties to make substantial gains one way or the other these days. And part of that has to do with the way that the districts are drawn. But I'll also note that we as a society are just self-sorting in the communities in which we live, and increasingly are moving to areas that are like communities so that they are ideologically consistent with our own perspectives. And so it's just increasingly easy, regardless of where you live, to draw very Democratic or very Republican districts. And the battleground is really these communities that are fast growing and transitioning away from previous political orientations to something more different.
Yeah, the demographics are changing, which we'll talk, particularly in the urban areas, and we'll talk about that as we go through the program here. Democrats have been shut out of Raleigh for quite a while now. Is this breaking of the supermajority, John Hood, and the rejection of the two most controversial of the six constitutional amendments, the two that were opposed by all living governors. Was that voter reaction to what they saw as legislative overreach? Was it a response to Donald Trump, or was something else at play here?
Well, all of these things are in play to some extent, but keep in mind those two amendments on judicial vacancies and the Board of Elections ethics composition, those were defeated by bipartisan majorities. I don't mean that all the majority of the Republicans voted, but many Republican voters who voted for Republicans in maybe all races voted against those two amendments. So it wasn't, those two amendments were defeated certainly because the public didn't like them, thought they were too complicated, thought they might shift the balance of power improperly. That wasn't exactly itself evidence of a sort of a leftward shift in the electorate. It was broader than that. One of the things I looked at was the Court of Appeals races a little bit down the ballot because they were sort of a clean comparison. There weren't any third parties or three candidates in a race. And if you compare 2016 to 2018, it was a pretty evident shift of 4, maybe 5 points in favor of the Democrats statewide for the statewide Court of Appeals seats. That tells you there was a shift. Again, as Jonathan said, that blue wave or not is more of a semantic distinction. It was definitely a good Democratic year in North Carolina and in most of the country.
You've warned in the past, you've warned both parties in the past of the fact that the wheel of politics always turns. I think those are your words. And to be careful what they do or how they handle themselves, because it may leave them in a weaker position if the political tides turn. Is that what happened here? Are Republicans going to regret some of the things that they did or the way they handled things when they had that supermajority and when they had the governor's mansion as well?
Well, I think they already regret some of it. I don't think this is a speculative question. I think that it is arguable, at least, that the shenanigans that were played about the 2016 Supreme Court race likely cost the Republicans a seat, despite their best efforts to the contrary. I'm not sure that's quite the same storyline in 2018. It's possible the Democratic candidate would have won even if there had been no machinations. But both Democrats and Republicans in North Carolina have had a history in the last 20 years of trying to game the system and rig the system in their favor. And, you know, sometimes it works, at least in the short run, but a lot of times it comes back to bite them in the end, and it just illustrates what your mama told you, which is, you know, act according to the rules, behave yourself, it'll usually work out to your benefit.
So do you think that maybe the fact that the voters voted down those two amendments that would have weakened the governor's power might be regarded by Republicans in future years as a good thing?
Well, obviously, if you have a Republican governor in 2021... and a split legislature, Democratic legislature, and before people say, well, that could never happen, of course it could happen. This is a highly competitive state. Something like that could certainly occur. And at that point, Republicans would thank their lucky stars that the Republican governor got to appoint judicial vacancies without Democratic control and that they could staff the elections board. So, yeah, the point here is whether it's putting party labels on the ballot or taking party labels off the ballot, or changing constitutional powers in various ways, lawmakers and the voters need to be making these decisions based on what they think would be best for the system, not what they think would be best for their party. Not only would that be the wrong motivation, but they will get it wrong many times.
Had there never been a supermajority in the legislature, Senator, what would be different today?
Everything would be different. I mean, you would have a ton of laws that had never passed, especially if Governor McCrory had been in the mood to exercise a veto, knowing that his veto could be sustained. I always thought that Governor McCrory desperately wanted the supermajority to be broken because he, frankly, wasn't really relevant as governor, and a Democratic minority could have made him relevant. History would be very different. HB 2, for instance, may never have occurred.
I want to talk about relevance because you've been in that chamber for a while now, and it's been controlled by Republicans, and you're a Democrat, and I want to find out what that felt like.
Yeah, I think you know.
Well, no, I want to hear it from you, though. And we'll do that when we come back, among other things, in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about politics in the aftermath of the midterm election with Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democrat from Mecklenburg County. Jonathan Kapler joins us via Skype, Executive Director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. And John Hood is with us by phone, the President of the John William Pope Foundation and Chairman of the John Locke Foundation. Just before the break, Senator Jackson, you said we were talking about being relevant, and Pat McCrory, when he was governor, kind of being irrelevant to the legislature because it was all about the legislature. What about him? You've been a Democrat in a Republican-controlled legislature for quite a while. What's it like?
Here's what it's like. I drive up, I park outside, I walk to the front door of the building. I'm met there by Republican leadership. They say, "Hey, Jeff." I say, "Hey, guys." They say, "You know the deal. Come with us." And then they lead me down into the basement where everyone in my party is tied to a chair. And they say, "You know the deal." And so what I was telling people in the run-up to this campaign was we need to break the supermajority so that we can get the cavalry to ride in here and untie us from the chairs. That doesn't mean we run the place anymore, but at least we are part of the conversation now.
I mean, did they talk to you? Did they?
Yeah, very social. They're very cordial about it.
But did they consult with you on what your take was on a particular policy here or there? Or do they just know you're completely irrelevant, you have no vote, so we're not even going to talk to you about it?
On very small bills, things that would never hit the headlines, you can be part of a conversation if you really work at it. If you've established a personal relationship and you know you've got some area of expertise there. I used to be a prosecutor, so I've been able to influence some criminal law legislation. But there has not been a single bill of real significance on which I saw any bipartisanship whatsoever.
And was it that way when the Democrats controlled everything? Did Republicans experience the same thing?
You know, Democrats will say, no, we were better, but I assure you there have been at least several instances in which Democrats, when they were in power, horribly abused their power over the minority. There's no question about that. With regards to the budget specifically, we played all kinds of procedural games. We didn't let them read the budget. We forced them to take unpopular votes. We really, to John Hood's earlier point, the goal here should be breaking a cycle of crummy politics that we've seen in North Carolina.
When one party is campaigning against the other party, I don't care which party you're in, demonizes the party that maybe vying for their positions, and it's going to be the end of the world if they get elected, and businesses will fail, and the Republic will go down to destruction. And the
caravan.
Caravan. Jonathan Kapler, Russia, I mean, not Russians, Republicans. Republicans are pro-business, and they've been known to tell voters that if Democrats come into power, they will, it will lead to greater regulation of business, hurt the economy, lead to a loss of jobs. Since I believe your job with North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation is to deal with businesses around the state, is that a concern here now that Republicans are not fully in control?
Well, I tend to think of things in an optimistic framing where I don't think extremism helps on either side of the political spectrum for the business community. The business community, by and large, in North Carolina likes stability. And so to a certain extent, I mean, there's a school of thought that divided government in North Carolina, which we have effectively now following the 2018 elections, could generate much more stability in our tax policy and social policy that's caused some consternation in recent years. And, you know, you go back to the early 2000s when Democrats and Republicans were evenly split in the state house and we had co-speakers, one Republican, one Democrat. And really the legislation, I wasn't really fully engaged in the political process back then, but it was my understanding from folks who were there that there was a lot of legislating that was really just down the middle. You had to have Republican and Democratic votes to make anything work. And so potentially that could be the case going forward here. And that might be a good thing for the business community and the state as a whole.
So, John Hood, from what you know of Republicans, who are some of them licking their wounds, I suppose, what do you think this is going to look like for the next couple of years? Will we see Republicans and Democrats working together to get things done? Or will there simply be gridlock because we're not going to let you have your way if we can help it?
Well, I certainly have my druthers. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you looking for John Hood?
This is the problem with all the Johns in the room.
That's right.
What I would say is I think that there's not going to be a unanimous response. The Republicans are licking their wounds. They are thinking about the special session coming up and then the regular session beginning next year. And I don't think they're all of one mind about this. On the one hand, when Jonathan brings up the co-speakership back in the previous decade, well, for many Republicans who were around then and who were in the legislature, them's fighting words. I mean, they viewed that as corrupt. You know, that there was a Republican who was paid to switch parties. He ultimately went to prison. There was a Speaker of the House who manipulated the process to generate that outcome. He went to prison. They do not see that period of time as bipartisan and good. They perceive it as dishonest and bad. So we have to think through how the different Republicans will respond. Some of them believe the problem is they didn't sharpen the distinctions enough and raise enough money to defeat these Democrats in these urban counties, and they'll just do it 2 years from now, no problem. But others are looking more closely at the results and thinking through what happened and realizing that they lost some voters who had voted Republican in recent cycles, either because of the Trump factor, which we haven't probably mentioned enough of. Why does Trump have anything to do with the General Assembly? Because the head of the ticket always has something to do with every election in a midterm.
Well, he also said this election is about me.
Well, he says that a lot. I mean, everything's about him.
Well, everything is.
But in this particular case, he's not dissembling. The electorate is affected by that. I've talked to some voters in Wake and Mecklenburg County, both, who typically vote Republican, didn't really dislike the Republican incumbents for legislature or even county commission, in the case of Mecklenburg, but decided to cast a protest vote against President Trump. Now, you know, will that be around in 2 years? We'll see. But the other part of it that some Republicans are thinking through is, how did they run these campaigns in these urban areas and inner suburbs? Were they talking about solving problems? Were they talking about passing legislation to address issues? Or were they just talking in symbolism? A lot of voters aren't liking that, particularly in these suburban areas. So I think Republicans are, after they finish licking their wounds, they'll figure it out. And what we'll probably end up with is a combination of some bipartisan legislation in some areas, as well as votes designed to get people on the record, pro or con, to be used in the next legislative elections.
So, Jonathan Kepler, as you watched this election and these campaigns unfold, what were they talking about? What seemed to resonate with voters from both sides of the aisle?
Well, we had some perennial issues that campaigns are talking about. Education funding and teacher salaries were a prime focus of Democratic candidates across the state. Republicans, by and large, are trying to focus on economic themes and advances that they had made from their perspective in taxation policy at the state level, and to try and meet the Democrats where they were in terms of their arguments on education funding. They were trying to highlight the Republican incumbents, trying to highlight the growth in teacher salaries under their watch. Although I'm not exactly sure that resonated with the voters who were upset with education funding to begin with. There were also a series of local issues that were at play across the state that were locally impactful. You know, the I-77 toll issue, of course, in Mecklenburg County is something that was a factor in several legislative campaigns there. Hurricane recovery and response in eastern North Carolina, overall transportation funding in the Triangle, things of that nature. And so by and large, though, I think the election cycle was colored by President Trump and response to him, as John indicated, and the main Democratic campaign theme, which was uniform throughout the state, which was we need to break the Republican supermajority to restore some balance in state government.
Republicans have been walking with spiked combat boots, stomping over Democrats now for several years in the legislature. Is there going to be a hangover from that? Is there going to be resentment from that, Senator? What's the Democratic approach going to be? Is there going to be a detente of some sort? Or are you going to come in there and do whatever you can to change things right now because, by God, we finally have some power?
Well, there's no way to really express that resentment through any political leverage that we have because we're still in the minority. Our leverage is only the ability to sustain the governor's veto. And the governor's going to take, I think, a very disciplined approach to using that newfound leverage. I don't think he's going to go in there and start swinging a baseball bat. None of us are going to encourage him to do that. We want to take what little leverage we have and use it to the best extent possible to try and show our constituents and the people of the state, you weren't wrong when you elected a bunch of Democrats. We understand what this state could be. We understand the need for further funding for public education. What we campaigned on, our top priorities, are going to remain our top priorities. And we should look at what the governor, Northam in Virginia, was able to do to get Medicaid expanded, because he was able to do that despite having Democrats in the minority, just by one or two votes, I think, in the General Assembly, their state legislature. And can Governor Cooper, work with the Republicans to get Medicaid expanded, because a lot of us campaigned on that, and the state overwhelmingly wants it to happen.
Just as is the case in Washington, you don't come into power, and the balance of power does not shift until January, and the legislature is going into what is called the lame duck session, and one of the things that they'll be doing is writing the enabling legislation for these constitutional amendments that passed, the most controversial of which is the voter ID amendment. Voters said yes to that because the majority of people across the country believe in voter ID. I think it's 74% of those polled believe in it. But in North Carolina, we kind of voted blind because we don't know exactly what the wording will be, what types of ID you can have, etc., going into this. Will the legislature, John Hood, likely be prudent in the way they write this, given the balance of power being about to shift up there? Or will this be a last-ditch effort to shove things through the way they want them before Democrats have some say in the matter?
I think the critical variable here is not so much the change in the legislative makeup, it's the change in the courts. On the one hand, there's probably more confidence on the Republican side than there used to be that any federal challenge of voter ID or other election law changes will get to the U.S. Supreme Court and they will win them. I mean, remember, they believe that the previous version would have been upheld by the Supreme Court if not for sabotaging the case. So the federal courts they feel more confident about, but they should feel less confident, of course, about the state courts. And it's possible that even though this is a constitutional amendment, there could be a state constitutional challenge of a voter ID law that's too restrictive on the grounds that, as applied, it is discriminatory or something like that. So I think they will craft their legislation carefully in order to defend it in court. They know a lawsuit is coming.
And with the recent addition of Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court, is there, if it goes to Washington, do they feel that their case is strengthened?
They do feel that it's strengthened, but again, as long as there is not strong evidentiary argument that it's being done in a discriminatory manner. Voter ID has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court a number of times. Kavanaugh is probably less likely than Kennedy was to go with some of the arguments that challengers of voter ID laws have often posited. That doesn't mean that it's a slam dunk. It just means they feel more confident about the federal case. My point is there could be a state court case, and they have to consider that as they draft the bill.
So we've seen over the last couple of years, Jonathan Kapler, this pattern of the Republican-controlled legislature passing certain laws that were then vetoed by the governor, and then they would come back and override the governor's veto, and in some incidents, the governor or other entities would sue, and the courts would get involved. Now that the supermajority has been broken, are we likely to see a continuation of that pattern, or will we see much less of that going forward?
I think it's a little bit hard to say. And just, you know, for context here, the governor has issued 25 vetoes, which is a record. He's been overridden 20 times, which is also a record. And we could continue to see that gamesmanship play out where vetoes go back and forth. But I do agree with earlier statements that it's harder for a coalition to be cobbled together to override Governor Cooper's vetoes in North Carolina. Having said that, we still have lots of outstanding litigation between the legislature and the governor that will be proceeding for the next couple of years at least. And it's a dizzying amount of litigation. So it can be very confusing to understand where things stand, including ongoing back and forth about the State Board of Elections and ethics enforcement, which was also the subject of one of these constitutional amendments. And so I think that we are not out of the woods as it relates to the litigation, although given the shift in Raleigh between the legislature and the balance of power there, that we may see perhaps a little bit less of it simply because legislation won't be getting enacted into law overriding the governor's veto.
So if we continue to see this back and forth at locking of horns between the two parties in the legislature and the Republicans versus the governor going forward for the next 2 years, who wins and who loses in that scenario? I'm not sure. Go ahead, Senator.
So I think what you're going to see, if I can make a reckless prediction, I think the veto is going to have mainly a deterrent effect. Because I think if you're Republican leadership, the worst case scenario is you file a bunch of bills, the governor vetoes them all, all those vetoes get sustained, and now you've just made the governor look strong. You've showcased the importance of the governor being at the table. I think there's going to be a lot of behind-the-scenes conversations between the governor and leadership to make sure, okay, if we pass this, is this something you are willing to sign? Uh-huh. With the big exception being the budget. I think Republican leadership has a strong political incentive to help out their buddy Dan Forrest, lieutenant governor, who's probably the presumptive nominee at this point to run for governor, to give him ammunition by passing a bunch of budgets that have poison pills in them that they know the governor will veto, so that Dan Forrest can say, look, I'm running against someone who vetoed money for teachers, money for firefighters, all the good stuff that's in the budget. So there will be a grand battle around the budget. But other than that, there may be relatively few vetoes.
So are you saying that essentially if they fight the governor, that makes the governor relevant? And that's not a good thing for Republicans?
Yeah, I think they want to minimize the number of sustained vetoes for their own political purposes.
Okay. And if they do try to do this, does this make the Republican Party appear to be John Hood obstructionist? Or does it tell the base they're sticking up for what they believe in and what I believe in, and therefore they need to be voted in more strongly in 2 years?
Well, in a sense, this is a kind of a replay of the drama that we saw with President Obama and the Republican Congress. Now, the difference being that, of course, the federal government borrows money. You don't have to balance the budget. But the fights between the Congress and President Obama, or even President Clinton back in the 90s, illustrated to Republicans that one person versus an amalgam of people, the one person has messaging advantages, particularly if that person is the chief executive. So picking a fight, as Jeff says, with the legislature over the budget might very well be, generally speaking, to Roy Cooper's benefit, depending upon the specifics. But keep in mind, there is a law in place, as I recall, that if there's no budget passed by the end of the fiscal year, then there is you don't need a continuing resolution necessarily. You just have funding continue at the current levels. The Republicans probably think that strengthens their hand. I agree with the senator that the budget is likely to be the largest flashpoint between the two sides.
So, Jonathan Kapler, I have less than a minute left. We've had divided government in North Carolina before. Is it necessarily a bad thing for the state?
It's not necessarily a bad thing for the state, but I think that model from back in 2011 and 12 doesn't necessarily apply given the ideological purity of the two parties now, which have sorted out, and there are fewer moderates in both parties to negotiate real substantial deals from. So I think that there could be a lot of good to come out of this, but it'll be issue by issue as opposed to some general governing coalition.
Jonathan Kapler is executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. John Hood is here. He's the president of the John William Pope Foundation, chairman of the John Locke Foundation, and Senator Jeff Jackson represents Mecklenburg County in the legislature. He's with us as well in our studio. And we are coming right back in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking politics after the midterm election with Senator Jeff Jackson, Jonathan Kapler from the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, and John Hood with the John William Pope Foundation and the John Locke Foundation. John Hood, you wrote an article for the Rocky Mount Telegram in which you said that in this last election, Democrats' investment in state races was far more productive than it was in national or congressional races. But isn't that where the future lies? Wasn't that the Republican secret for the success they've had in recent years? Start local, build a base, move it national.
Indeed it was. In fact, it isn't just winning legislative seats, which does several things for you. It allows you to potentially draw congressional and legislative lines in a future election. But it also grooms candidates who might be running for Congress later or Senate later. And it strengthens your ability to convey your messages on issues because you can do things at the legislative level. But actually, Republicans started even earlier than that at the local level, winning county commission races and so forth in places that Republicans had never been able to do that. What's happened more recently is that strategy has been pursued by Democrats, both in urban counties at the local level. We now have our two most populous counties have entirely Democratic county commissions, which is hard to imagine just a few years ago. At the same time, Republicans actually have more county commissions than they used to, but they're now in rural areas that have flipped from Democratic to Republican. So yes, building early, building lower on the ballot is a viable strategy. The Democrats are pursuing it, and how that affects Congress and the national conversation in 2021 and 2022 will, of course, depend on the fate of redistricting reform, which has made some inroads in other states, and I think there will now be a serious push again in North Carolina in 2019.
So we have an email from Kirby, one of our listeners, who writes, will Democrats be able to hold these new seats in the next election? What's stopping the GOP from mounting a Take Back the Supermajority campaign? Jonathan Kapler, you're the nonpartisan entity here. What's your take?
Well, I think that there's definitely going to be a lot of competitive state legislative contests in 2020, which will be a totally different election cycle than 2018. President Trump, we would expect to be back on the ballot, driving turnout again, including in some of these Republican-leaning areas that Democrats did quite well in this year's election. Democrats still have some rural-based districts across the state at the state legislative level that are very vulnerable to high Republican turnout in a presidential election year. And so there are still opportunities for Democrats in some of these suburban communities as well. And so I don't think that this is by any stretch a period at the end of the sentence in North Carolina politics. This is an ellipsis, and we will march on till 2020, where there will be a number of competitive contests and lots and lots of money.
Senator Jackson, the Raleigh News and Observer reported that the governor will spend the next 2 years pushing for issues he has long promoted, such as the expansion of Medicare, raising pay for teachers at all ranges of experience, disaster relief, stronger emphasis on pollution control, cleaning up the water, etc. Is that the agenda of lawmakers, Democratic and Republican lawmakers, but particularly Democratic lawmakers in the legislature?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we line up really nicely with the governor, and if we didn't, you wouldn't hear from us anyway, because his microphone is so much bigger than ours. If our message was different than his, you might not ever note that, simply because, as was noted earlier, he can command the press in a way that we can't.
Can you find Republicans to work with you?
Oh, absolutely. The whole trick is whether leadership can bring it to the fore. There are a bunch of Republicans with whom you can work on all types of, even with Medicaid expansion, which has been one of the most controversial issues. There are five or six Republicans in the House who co-sponsored a bill to expand Medicaid in their own version, in their own particular way. It's all about will leadership let it come to a vote.
And what if they don't?
Well, then the governor has to make a decision about how far he is willing to push his leverage, which is the veto. Is he going to start demanding that certain bills that he wants be incorporated into other bills in order to gain his signature?
Mm-hmm. John Hood, with or without this supermajority, Republicans changed a lot around the state since they reclaimed power from Democrats after, I think, 100 years. What is there left to do? I mean, if they hadn't broken the supermajority, what would you guys be up to for the next several years? What was left on the agenda that was undone?
Well, I think that's actually an important point, that once any kind of political movement accomplishes its highest priorities, it does tend to lose a little steam. And the Republicans, when they took the legislature in 2010, they had some very clear objectives stated as they ran regarding government spending and tax cuts and deregulation, parental choice in education, a variety of other subjects. Well, they've done legislation or passed budgets addressing all of those priorities to varying degrees. I think what they should have done is pivot towards some other issues that people care about. Health care is an obvious one. Not sure I agree with Senator Jackson that Medicaid was their missed opportunity, though we'll see how that gets negotiated out. I think they should have talked more about the cost of health care, deregulation, allowing people to provide services at a lower cost through more competition and so forth. They do need to pivot to some other messages that are still consistent with conservative themes. But your point is well taken. I don't think that they're about to propose or would have proposed with a supermajority large tax cuts again, because everybody recognizes that we've got a potential recession sometime soon. Eventually recessions happen. We've got a hurricane that is going to be depleting some of our rainy day reserves. So the Republican legislature is going to fund necessary programs and save money. So they do have a lot to say. I'm not sure they said it all in the 2018 cycle, but all political movements have a bit of an arc. And the conservative movement that drove Republican gains in the early part of this decade has accomplished a great deal, and they're focused mostly on retaining what they consider to be those policy advances.
Nationally, voters seem to be saying that health care, particularly continued coverage of pre-existing conditions, was important to them. And Republicans in North Carolina have prevented the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and really didn't do much to help Obamacare succeed. Some people would say that they put up roadblocks to see that it failed. Now that they know that these issues have caught on with voters, are they likely to cooperate with Democrats and with Governor Cooper on these issues, Jonathan Kapler? And if they don't, will there be a political price to pay in 2 years?
Well, I think the policy decisions that are going to be made here in Raleigh and in Washington follow political incentives. And so in these battleground legislative and congressional districts, I think the question that party leadership in both the national level and in the state level will be making political calculations based on whether or not it is going to be helpful to them to moderate their path a bit on the Republican side and for Democrats to push these things, continue to push these things, or are the incentives leading them to double down on their opposition to these. So I think that is the political calculus that will come to play. And again, 2020 will be a very different political environment than 2018. So I think that remains to be seen.
One thing people of both parties do, John Hood, when they're in power, is sometimes package things in unappetizable nuggets. In other words, they know the governor and the Democrats want X. So we'll give you X, but we're going to bundle it in this bill that also has Y and Z. And if you vote against X, you vote against Y and Z, you're voting against X, and that'll hurt you politically. Are we likely to see a lot of that going forward?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's been common since the 90s. The 1790s. This is basically how legislative horse trading has often occurred, how legislative strong-arming has often occurred. Senator Jackson called it poison pill strategies, and certainly those will exist. I do think that there are some bills that Republicans want there to be a vote on, and they want it to be defeated, and they want the Democrats to be on record, and perhaps Governor Cooper to be on record. So again, mm-hmm. We talked about this earlier. There's a trade-off between we're showing that we're doing the business of North Carolina, voters should reward us by reelecting us, and there's some Democrats in traditionally Republican areas. We need to force some votes that will make those Democrats be in vulnerable positions in 2020. I think both of those kinds of Republican responses are likely.
North Carolina GOP Executive Director Dallas Woodhouse has said over the course of the next 2 years, quote, we're going to pass Republican bills. We're going to pass a Republican budget. We're going to pass a Republican agenda. We'll see if the governor works with us. Senator, is that bluster or is there truth to that? Is he being realistic?
That is bluster. He gets paid to say exactly those words. But there's also truth to that. I mean, look, it's not as if when we go back into session, Republican leadership is going to reach out to the Democrats and say, meet with us. Let's form a bipartisan agenda. Let's determine where we can work together. There's no muscle memory for that. Even if they sort of wanted to do that, they haven't done that for an entire decade. I'm not sure they really know how to take the first step, at least in the Senate. The House is a little bit different. So, no, I would be shocked if it were anything other than them trying to stay as close as possible to what they have done for this entire decade.
Is that a wise thing for them to do, Jonathan Kapler?
Honestly, I think what we need to wait for is leadership elections. The House majority has shrunk, looks to maybe be 65-55 majority there. And Speaker Moore will have to be reelected by his caucus to be leader of that chamber. And I think the strategy of whoever is actually leading the state house and the specific committee chairman and whether or not any Democrats are part of that conversation is something that is indicative of how those approaches will go.
And you've said, Senator, that you have heard overwhelming calls for ending gerrymandering. You've also said that you know there are Republicans ready to do that.
It passed.
Really? Who are they?
It passed. I mean, look, to the Republicans' credit, it passed the House after the Republicans took over. So there was a Republican majority within this time of Republican supermajorities.
How do you end it? Because the Democrats did this when they had the House and Senate. So how do you end it?
And that's an important caveat. My party had the opportunity to end this for decades, and we didn't want to because we wanted to rig the game in our own favor. And to John Hood's credit, on the line with us, he has been a strong proponent of ending this gerrymandering for a long time. Here's one idea. One idea is to take the State Board of Ethics and Elections, which the Republicans reformed. They tried to reform it again through the constitutional amendment, which failed. But that was preceded by a reforming that basically made it four Republicans, four Democrats, and one unaffiliated picked by that group. And you make it the State Board of Ethics, Elections, and Redistricting, because they entrusted this group to make partisan decisions that affect elections by making it balanced. So if you're willing to do that with respect to election decisions, maybe you're willing to do that with respect to redistricting.
John Hood, what's the Republican version of that? And is there, can you really find anybody who is unaffiliated? They may be unaffiliated, but they lean one way or the other.
That is the nature of the problem, and that's why while I understand the intention of Senator Jackson's suggestion, it won't fly because it would just be putting the Democrats in charge of drawing the maps. A more likely scenario, because the unaffiliated voter is a Democrat, basically. Okay, so we have to avoid that. That is what has happened in other states where apparently nonpartisan, apparently independent members of redistricting boards have just been schemes. They've just been putting Democrats or Republicans under the radar onto the commission. We can't have that sort of thing. It will be a poison pill, and it'll kill the entire idea. What I think has actually happened that makes this a much stronger possibility in 2019 is, number one, the Republicans can't be sure they'll be in charge after the 2020 elections, and they want to take out, or many want to take out, an insurance policy against a catastrophic loss, a gerrymandering against them in 2021. But the other more important phenomenon is the state courts. Future legislatures will draw, if they draw maps, they'll go in front of the North Carolina Supreme Court. It's now a 5-2 Democratic court. Whether this is a fair characterization or not, many Republicans in the Capitol now are thinking, if redistricting goes to the Democratic court, they will gerrymander us. We will be destroyed. We have to avoid that. We can't let those Democratic politicians on the Supreme Court draw the maps. And so we need an alternative system. I think that whatever you think about the merits of the argument, it's a persuasive argument for Republicans who used to be against redistricting reform. And I do think it creates the opportunity to make this happen in 2019 and put it on the ballot for a constitutional amendment in 2020.
Jonathan Kapler, do you think this vote that broke the supermajority is an indication by voters that they want to change the direction of the state by electing Democrats who will take it in a different direction, or do they simply want the legislature to stop being a bully?
I think that the vote is hard to interpret any other way than voters wanted to put Democrats at the table in a way that they haven't been. I think that is the outcome of the vote in the U.S. House, where the majority is now in the Democrats' hands. So I think that they wanted a dynamic shift, and they've got it.
So we also saw here and around the country this time a sharp divide between urban, suburban areas and rural areas. Democrats seem to have the urban, suburban areas sewn up. Republicans own the rural areas. Would they be well advised to try to better understand Democrats? Would they be well advised to try to better understand and speak to rural voters and their needs prior to 2020 if they want to pick up further seats in legislatures and in Congress? And is that possible? John Hood, first.
Well, I do think that both parties have to look in areas where they've lost ground. But just real quick, the inner suburbs have tilted Democratic in the last election. The outer suburbs are pretty very strongly Republican. Otherwise, Republicans would be out of business. So the suburbs are actually a battleground, and both sides will be focused on those inner and outer suburbs in 2020.
Senator Jackson, we have about 20 seconds.
Agreed. The suburbs are the battleground.
But can you speak to rural voters?
Absolutely. I just don't think that message is going to be heard with Trump in office. He drowns out everything we say.
Jonathan Kapler, I'll give you the last word in 15 seconds. What's your take?
Yeah, absolutely. I think rural areas moving further to the right and the suburbs are really where Democrats can make gains.
Jonathan Kapler is the executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. John Hood is president of the John William Pope Foundation and the chairman of the John Locke Foundation. And Senator Jeff Jackson is the Democrat from Mecklenburg County who is back in it for another couple of years.
Back in it.
In the legislature. Thank you all. for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.